Chapter 13. Planning for Retirement. Retirement without study is death. Seneca, Epistles. The Revolutionary War, it could be said, ended with an act of reading. After hostilities between American and British forces concluded at Yorktown, George Washington had to cope with conflict of a different sort as he faced disgruntled Continental officers ready to mutiny. Their pay in arrears and their pensions in jeopardy, they would rebel if their demands were not met. Having petitioned Congress in late 1782, they learned the following March that the nation's legislators had rejected their petition, snubbing the very men who had fought to win the nation its freedom. On March 15, 1783, General Washington met with representative officers to deliver a speech and read the message from Congress. Standing before them, he looked at the men and then looked at the message, paused for a moment, removed his spectacles from his pocket, and placed them on his nose. "Gentlemen, you must pardon me," he said. "I have grown gray in your service and now find myself growing blind." Washington then proceeded to read the message from Congress. He scarcely needed to utter another word. Having maintained a facade of invulnerability throughout the war, he briefly let his mask slip before this gathering of Continental officers. For a moment they realized that he too had suffered during the war. He too had given his all in the revolutionary cause and grown old in the process. After finishing the message, he left the officers alone to debate what to do. Little debate was necessary. They adopted resolutions affirming their loyalty to Congress. Washington, in turn, wrote Congress to voice their grievances himself. With that fiery situation diffused, Washington had several lesser tasks to accomplish as he brought the war to conclusion. He set April 19th, the 8th anniversary of Lexington and Concord, as the official end of hostilities. Finally, he could look forward to returning home. 8 months would pass before he reached Mount Vernon, but he did not need to wait until he was back in Virginia to start planning his retirement. From Newburgh, he could tie up many loose ends. He also spent time imagining what life would be like after he resigned his commission as Commander-in-Chief. For one thing, he would catch up on his reading. Over the past 8 years, he had read little other than military manuals and official communiques, and now he longed for leisure, time enough to relax at Mount Vernon and enjoy his well-earned rest. From early spring through the summer of 1783, Washington spent time perusing booksellers' catalogs and deciding which books to buy. It would be easier to stock up on reading material when he was near New York City than after he returned to Mount Vernon. To help him in this literary task, he recruited the services of William Stephen Smith, an aide-de-camp stationed in the city. After receiving an excellent education at the College of New Jersey, Smith had joined the Continental Army and served as an officer throughout the war. He would later become secretary to the American legation in England under John Adams and Adams's son-in-law once he married his daughter Abigail. The earliest books Smith bought for Washington were three recently published travel narratives, which he sent to him in March 1783, Arthur Young's Tour in Ireland, and two by Dr. John Moore, A View of Society and Manners in France, Switzerland, and Germany, and A View of Society and Manners in Italy. Young had already established himself as one of Britain's leading agricultural experts. Washington had known about him since the mid-1760s, when Young contributed several articles to Museum Rusticum. His contributions to this serialized collection of agricultural and technical essays stress the importance of both practical experimentation and empirical observation. He subsequently toured Europe himself to observe different methods of farming. Young's travel writings detail the practice of husbandry in the lands through which he traveled. Many contemporary readers preferred his entertaining and informative travel books to Young's purely agricultural works. Tour in Ireland offered the kind of reading material Washington liked best, an amusing travel narrative interspersed with useful observations. Admitting that Ireland was somewhat backwards in terms of its agricultural technology, Young argued that no place was so backwards that it could not have some good practices to copy. Young, who had great respect for General Washington, would initiate a correspondence with him a few years later, and the two men would correspond sporadically over the next decade and a half, exchanging their thoughts about agricultural theory and practice. As a mark of his respect, Young would present Washington with several of his books. Though Dr. John Moore separately published A View of Society and Manners in France, Switzerland, and Germany, and A View of Society and Manners in Italy, the two works, totaling 5 volumes in the Dublin edition, were known collectively as Moore's Travels. John Gillies, an 18th-century historian, enjoyed Moore's candor, discernment, and objectivity, but appreciated most his narrative approach, which situated personal insights within a fast-paced tale of travel. By presenting a continual scene of action to the eye, Gillies observed, Moore enables the mind of his reader to anticipate his just and natural, though by no means obvious, reflections. Moore's travels proved to be enormously popular, going through several editions during the early 1780s. Washington's acquisition of both Young's Tour in Ireland and Moore's Travels reflects his desire to catch up with the latest British literature now that the war was over. Though he was buying books to take back to Mount Vernon, the documentary evidence suggests that Washington did not wait until he got home to begin reading his new books. He started Moore's Travels at Newburgh. The work reminded him how pleasurable reading could be. He soon wrote a letter to Smith listing the titles of several books he wished to buy. Reading a newspaper advertisement from a New York bookseller, Washington wrote Smith a follow-up letter requesting many additional books. The most renowned part of Moore's travels is his account of Voltaire, which combines anecdotes with its author's personal impressions of the great philosopher in his twilight. Moore observed, "The most piercing eyes I ever beheld are those of Voltaire, now in his 80th year. His whole countenance is expressive of genius, observation, and extreme sensibility." Reading Moore, Washington apparently grew eager to read Voltaire. Though he may have known Candide before the war, he now wished to broaden his knowledge of its author and asked Smith for 3 different Voltaire works, all available in English translation. Letters from Monsieur de Voltaire to several of his friends presents an English translation of selected correspondence. 18th-century authors customarily published ideas on a variety of subjects under the guise of personal letters. Voltaire was no exception. His accomplishments in other literary genres have overshadowed his letter writing, but readers in his time recognized what Owen Aldridge has called Voltaire's epistolary brilliance. Brief as it is, fewer than 200 pages, this edition forms a good introduction to the life and mind of Voltaire. Its text reveals Voltaire's playful style and particular interests as he treats such topics as books and booksellers, comedy and tragedy, dictionaries and encyclopedias, the Italian language, literary history, men of letters, philosophy, poetry, religious dogmatism, and science. Biography, a literary genre Voltaire attempted with uneven results, also appealed to Washington, whose curiosity about the lives of great men, especially great military men, extends back to his childhood. He asked Smith for 2 biographies by Voltaire, The History of Charles XII, King of Sweden, and The Age of Louis XV. Smith successfully obtained a copy of the first, which reveals Voltaire's strengths and weaknesses as a biographer. Voltaire lacked the scholarly rigor biography demands. He was more comfortable working in a colorful, imaginative, freewheeling style, supplying general impressions of his subject's life, rather than digging deeply through biographical arcana to connect together factual tidbits and create a unified whole. Furthermore, Voltaire was often willing to ignore biographical fact when it conflicted with his philosophy. Even when Voltaire is wrong, he remains entertaining and provocative. Unable to acquire a copy of Voltaire's Age of Louis XV, Smith obtained for Washington a different book on the subject by Mouflet d'Angerville, The Private Life of Louis XV. The title does not do the work justice. Mouflet d'Angerville elaborated both the private and the public life of Louis XV. Washington left no comments about the book, but it contains much to admire, being remarkably free from prejudice. British educator and essayist William Enfield said that its author speaks not as a Frenchman, but as a philosopher and citizen of the world. Facts are related with minuteness of detail, yet without tedious prolixity. Characters are drawn with striking features and boldness of coloring, and the narrative is frequently enlivened with entertaining anecdotes. The same time Washington placed the order for the works by Voltaire, he also asked for some histories by another influential French author, the Abbé Vertot. History of the Revolutions That Happened in the Government of the Roman Republic and History of the Revolutions in Portugal. Washington placed one condition on his request. He asked Smith to obtain them only if they are esteemed. This condition reflects both Washington's innocence and his experience. Having spent years commanding the Continental Army, he understood how to delegate responsibility, an understanding he now applied to the acquisition of books. He respected Smith's intelligence and discrimination, placing confidence in his ability to decide whether these two books deserved a place at Mount Vernon. Yet this condition also reveals Washington's limited knowledge of literature. Gauging by their titles, Vertot's works sounded like they might interest him, but he apparently did not know much about either of the works or their author. Washington's ignorance of the Abbé Vertot, the historian of revolutions, represents a significant gap in his literary knowledge. Vertot's writings were known throughout colonial America decades before the American Revolution, and they have been recognized for their influence on the thought of the Founding Fathers. Adams, Franklin, Jefferson, all had copies of Vertot's writings in their libraries. In fact, a copy of Vertot's History of the Revolutions in Sweden had been among the Custis books shelved at Mount Vernon for many years. Perhaps Washington never read it. Whereas other founding fathers had read Vertot before the American Revolution, Washington would read him after the war. His curiosity about Vertot's works shows him trying to understand the revolutionary experience more fully, to see how the American Revolution fit into the worldwide history of revolutions. Unable to obtain the three-volume edition of Vertot's History of the Revolutions of the Roman Republic, Smith did locate a different edition. He also acquired some books Washington had not specifically requested. Smith had a good enough sense of the general's literary tastes to obtain additional volumes for him. Encountering an edition of Robert Watson's History of the Reign of Philip II, King of Spain, Smith knew Washington would appreciate this biography, so he bought it for him. Watson's engaging style, intuitive judgment, and sense of drama kept contemporary readers riveted to his life of Philip II from beginning to end. Washington thanked Smith for having the foresight to send him a copy. Washington also asked Smith to forward other available booksellers' catalogs so he could select additional volumes for his Mount Vernon library. No New York booksellers published separate catalogs in 1783. They did continue to advertise sale books in the newspapers. Smith sent Washington a copy of one New York newspaper containing a bookseller's advertisement listing many titles he thought Washington might like. The third week of June, Washington ordered several works from the list Smith had sent. Some were similar to ones he had recently obtained, biographies of military leaders and heads of state, but others show Washington broadening his interests to encompass natural history, philosophy, and the sciences. One major anthology would let him return to a favorite genre, travel writing. Washington hesitated to purchase a fairly expensive 20-volume collection of travels published under the title The World Displayed. He eventually let Smith determine its worth, placing the same condition on the purchase of The World Displayed he had placed on Vertot, if it is an esteemed work. With these latest requests, Smith continued to acquire substitute works for ones he could not obtain. Vicomte de Turenne, one of the greatest men of the 17th century, Rousseau thought, was another historical figure Washington hoped to understand. Smith, who could not locate the specific work Washington requested, did find another book on the subject, Andrew Michael Ramsay's History of Viscount de Turenne. Washington knew Ramsay as the author of Travels of Cyrus, a work he had at Mount Vernon. Ramsay's Life of Turenne, his second best work, has some drawbacks. Rousseau criticized Ramsay's decorum and thought the biography needed more anecdotes to bring out Turenne's true nature. Smith decided The World Displayed was an esteemed work that belonged in the Mount Vernon Library. He obtained the whole 20-volume set for Washington. The set has since been broken up, though Washington's autographed copy of the 12th volume survives. This particular volume includes a selection from a work Washington already knew, Thévenot's Travels into the Levant. It also contains Travels Through Egypt, a long and handsomely illustrated excerpt from Bishop Richard Pocock's Description of the East. Since Pocock visited Egypt in the late 1730s, his detailed account presents vital information about ancient Egyptian culture, information that was obliterated with the plundering of Egypt that occurred late in the century. Washington asked Smith for another big multi-volume work from his headquarters at Newburgh, Oliver Goldsmith's History of the Earth and Animated Nature. Goldsmith worked on this project off and on for the last 15 years of his life. When Samuel Johnson heard about it, he said of Goldsmith, "He has the art of compiling and of saying everything he has to say in a pleasing manner. He is now writing a natural history and will make it as entertaining as a Persian tale." Dr. Johnson's comment encapsulates Goldsmith's essential method: to rewrite an existing work of nonfiction to make it as entertaining as possible. When Goldsmith started Animated Nature, as it became known, he originally planned an updated version of Pliny's history. Once he encountered the early volumes of the Comte de Buffon's Histoire Naturelle, he recognized that Buffon's vast collection of curious details ideally suited his method. Goldsmith combined Buffon with other works of natural history. He referred to John Ray's Wisdom of God Manifested in the Works of Creation, for instance, to reconcile natural history and religion. Goldsmith's engaging style and sensitivity to public taste helped his work remain popular for decades. The most controversial yet influential aspect of Animated Nature is Goldsmith's human taxonomy. He created a hierarchy of human beings, putting each type in its place. Goldsmith situated the polar type at the bottom, two categories of Asians next, followed by Africans and Native Americans, with Europeans at the top. He subdivided the European category, ranking the English at the very top. The English are the whitest, Goldsmith asserted, and whiteness is the color to which mankind naturally tends. Disturbing from a modern perspective, this racist and chauvinistic theory found many welcome readers, and animated nature helped perpetuate such racist notions in the English-speaking world. Washington was now buying books so extensively that he tried to get them at a bulk discount. He still hesitated to buy too many. He did not want to duplicate titles he already had at Mount Vernon. Consequently, he wrote Lund, Washington, asking him to catalog the library there. Lund frankly admitted that he did not have much bibliographical skill, but agreed to do what he could. The catalog he created represents the first time the Mount Vernon Library had been inventoried since John Park Custis had removed his books and brought them to Abingdon. When Custis left Mount Vernon after his marriage, he had taken some of his stepfather's books with him, and left a few of his own. Loimologia, Nathaniel Hodges's graphic account of the London Plague, was one work he left at Mount Vernon. Some books Custis may have left behind intentionally. Given Washington's enjoyment of Alexander Pope, for instance, perhaps Custis gave his stepfather the broken set of Pope's poetical works. Dated July 23, 1783, Lund's list, even with its errors and omissions, presents a good picture of the Mount Vernon Library after John Custis had removed his books, but before George Washington returned from the war. Altogether, it lists 63 titles, totaling 98 volumes. Washington, a little surprised by how short Lund's list was, wondered how many of his books Custis had taken to Abingdon. He asked Lund to check the library there to see if any of its books contained his autograph or his bookplate and prepare a list of their titles. Either Lund never made the list, or it has since disappeared. As it stands, Lund's list somewhat misrepresents the size of the Mount Vernon Library, which easily contained more than 100 volumes. Lund was careless when it came to listing the number of volumes for each title. He listed several multi-volume works as single-volume ones. Some books he did not bother to mention by title at all, as a note near the end of the list indicates. Several old sermon and religious books that probably may never be read again, I did not think worth listing. Some pamphlets, plays, etc., etc., of but little worth. When George Washington had catalogued the Mount Vernon Library himself in 1764, he listed such books from his boyhood as Offspring Blackall's Sufficiency of a Standing Revelation and Matthew Hale's Contemplations. Unaware of the personal memories attached to these works, Lund Washington did not recognize their significance and did not list them separately, thinking they were just more stale old religious treatises. Counting the books at Mount Vernon, the handful of Washington books at Abingdon, and the war library in the green baize bookshelf Washington had with him at Newburgh, the total size of his personal library at the end of the Revolutionary War amounted to perhaps 150 volumes. All in all, it was a modest collection, especially compared with the libraries assembled by other founding fathers. This same year, Thomas Jefferson prepared the first detailed catalog of his library at Monticello, which contained approximately 2,000 volumes. It would triple in size over the next three decades. When Benjamin Franklin returned to the United States 2 years later, he combined his Paris library with his Philadelphia library, creating a collection totaling more than 4,000 volumes. Washington's personal collection of books was tiny compared with these great early American libraries. His library was smaller than those of Jefferson and Franklin, partly because he was neither an intellectual nor a bookman, but also because the Revolutionary War had interfered with his book-buying plans. Prior to the war, he had intended to expand his library significantly. After George and Martha married, the Custis Library largely fulfilled their pleasure-reading needs through the mid-1760s. By the end of the decade, George had begun adding to his collection of histories and travels. To that end, he had started reading current catalogs from the London booksellers. Perusing the latest sales catalog of Thomas Cadell, a bookseller located in the Strand in 1768, Washington found an item he absolutely had to have, Robert Beverley's History of Virginia. Beverley had published the first edition of his renowned history in London in 1705, with a revised edition in 1722. By 1768, copies of either were hard to find. Upon reading Cadell's catalog, Washington wrote his London agent and asked him to obtain Beverley's history for him. Washington's letter is filled with detail. He specifically mentioned where the book could be located. His agent did what Washington asked and acquired Beverley's history for him, the 1722 edition. Washington's biographers typically date his revolutionary activities to 1769, the year he joined the growing colonial opposition to the Townsend Acts. His request for Robert Beverley's History of Virginia the year before constitutes an important precursor. Beverley synthesized the ideas of the English opposition writers of the 17th century with a uniquely American perspective. His attack on rapacious and arbitrary governors, for example, foreshadows similar attacks in the run-up to the Revolution. Leo LeMay has called Beverley's History of Virginia the first sweeping, memorable, published indictment of a series of English governors. Beverley celebrates his American identity, characterizing himself on the title page of his history as a native and inhabitant of the place. Acquiring a copy of Beverley, Washington revealed his growing love of the land where he was born. Beverley influenced some of the ideas Washington and his neighbor and fellow patriot George Mason incorporated in the Fairfax County Resolves. It was 1771 when Washington had Stephen Vallescure, a London jeweler, engrave a handsome armorial bookplate, another indication of the pride he took in his library. Writing his agent to request the bookplate, he not only asked for the engraving, he also asked to have 400 or 500 copies struck. Since his personal collection of books amounted to fewer than 100 volumes at the time, Washington obviously hoped to expand his library 3- or 4-fold. A large personal library and an armorial bookplate fulfilled similar social functions. Both would impress visitors to Mount Vernon with a sense of sophistication and help elevate Washington to a status shared by the wealthiest planters. The armorial bookplate was a sign that he had arrived, that he had reached Virginia society's upper echelon. Lund's list reveals other books added to the Mount Vernon collection during the 1770s. George Washington obtained an English edition of Jean-Bernard Bossu's Travels Through Louisiana in 1772. Combining adventure, anthropology, geography, and natural history, this work contained much to allure Washington. Captain Bossu traveled through French North America during the 1750s. His autobiographical account has much in common with The Journal of Major Washington. As authors, both Washington and Bossu combined a military officer's sense of precision with a keen eye for detail. Bossu's account of Native American folkways in Travels Through Louisiana constitutes the work's most lasting contribution. It meticulously describes the Alabama, Arkansas, Choctaw, Fox, and Illinois Indians, detailing their marriage ceremonies and child-rearing customs, medical practices, and superstitions. Bosu's travels evinces a genuine appreciation for the Indians, championing Native American simplicity above an overly refined, even decadent, European society. Travels through Louisiana gave contemporary readers much food for thought. Classical scholar William Bellow, for one, found Bosu's depiction of the Native Americans similar to Herodotus's portrayal of the Scythians. Bellow used Bosu to annotate his edition of Herodotus, hypothesizing that North America was originally peopled from Northern Europe. Like other travel authors of his day, Bosu embellished his work with examples of Native American oratory. So many American travelers included Indian speeches in their works that they had almost become cliché. Reviewing Travels Through Louisiana, Jabez Hirons explained, "We generally read these Indian harangues with a degree of diffidence." John Reinhold Forster, Bosu's English translator, shared a similar opinion. At one point, Bosu quotes an old Indian who tells his men, "Go, my comrades, as men of courage and with the heart of a lion." Forster footnoted the closing prepositional phrase, calling it an hyperbole no Indian in America would make use of, not knowing that creature, which is not to be met with in that country. Though generally knowledgeable in the fields of natural history, Forster ignores the possibility that Bosu's Indian meant another type of cat that inhabited the North American wilderness, the panther. Regardless, his skepticism toward Native American oratory is well-founded. The presence of Bosu's travels through Louisiana at Mount Vernon reinforces Washington's interest in travel writing, but like his copy of Beverly's History of Virginia, it also reveals his curiosity about the meaning of America. How are the different parts of North America interrelated? What would happen once British colonial settlements continued farther west and approached French North America? As his own personal holdings in the Ohio Valley grew, Washington understood that the land Bosu described was not too far away from the land he owned, making travels through Louisiana not just a geographical curiosity, but also a practical manual. In the 1760s, Washington had invested in the Mississippi Land Company, which sought to secure a tract of more than 2 million acres east of the Mississippi River. Though he had written off his investment in what he called the Mississippi Adventure in January 1772, his acquisition of Bosu's travels showed that he remained curious about the region and still sought to learn as much about it as he could. Upon receiving Lund's list, George Washington could order additional books, confident he would not be duplicating any he already had at Mount Vernon. With what he ordered through William Stephen Smith, Washington increased the size of his personal library by nearly a third, bringing its total to around 200 volumes. His desire before the war to amass a library large enough to rival those of the wealthiest planters in Virginia may reflect his social ambitions. His book-buying spree after the war reflects his intellectual curiosity. He no longer needed to create a great library to verify his social status. George Washington was now the most widely revered man in America. He did not need to buy books as status symbols. The books he bought at the end of the war were ones he genuinely wanted to read during his retirement. In August, the Continental Congress summoned Washington to confer on the shape and size the American military should take in the post-war period. Congress was meeting in Princeton, New Jersey, temporarily, that is, after mutinous troops from Lancaster, Pennsylvania had descended on Philadelphia to demand back pay. Washington delayed his trip to Princeton until Martha, who had fallen ill at Newburgh, was healthy enough to travel. After stopping in Princeton, they hoped to proceed directly to Mount Vernon, so they arrived with considerable baggage. Washington established his headquarters about 4 miles outside Princeton at Rocky Hill, the home of Mrs. Margaret Berrien. Greetings from friends and well-wishers poured into Rocky Hill. One came in the form of a poem from Annis Boudinot Stockton, the sister of Elias Boudinot, current president of the Continental Congress. To General Washington, as she titled the poem, places him foremost, on the sacred scroll with patriots who had gained eternal fame by wondrous deeds that penetrate the soul. Flattered, Washington responded with a letter of thanks. His thank you letters are usually matter of fact. Writing to a poet, he demonstrated his own literary skill, assuming the fictional pose of an unworthy subject and crafting a simile with an allusion to the Book of Exodus. I must beg leave to say a word or two about these fine things you have been telling in such harmonious and beautiful numbers. Fiction is, to be sure, the very life and soul of poetry. All poets and poetesses have been indulged in the free and indisputable use of it, time out of mind. And to oblige you to make such an excellent poem on such a subject without any materials but those of simple reality would be as cruel as the Edict of Pharaoh, which compelled the children of Israel to manufacture bricks without the necessary ingredients. On Friday, September 5th, Washington hosted a dinner for the delegates to the Continental Congress. The Berrien home at Rocky Hill was not roomy enough to seat everyone, so Washington had his men erect a large tent they had confiscated from the British. Elias Boudinot sat to Washington's right, and the Chevalier de la Luzerne, the French minister, sat to his left. David Howell, a delegate from Rhode Island, may have had the best seat at the dinner. He sat directly across the table from Washington, and thus had the opportunity to hear everything he said. As Howell told a correspondent afterward, the repast was elegant, but the general's company crowned the whole. In his letter, Howell did more than simply express his appreciation for Washington's personal company. He also described the general's physical appearance and quoted some snippets of conversation. Having first met Washington toward the start of the war 8 years earlier, Howell could compare past and present. He wrote, "I observed with much pleasure that the general's front was uncommonly open and pleasant. The contracted, pensive air betokening deep thought and much care, which I noticed on Prospect Hill in 1775, is done away, and a pleasant smile, sparkling vivacity of wit and humor succeeds." Finally, Washington could let down his guard and indulge his sense of humor. According to Howell, his conversation that afternoon was sprinkled with playful repartee. When Boudinot remarked that Robert Morris, U.S. Superintendent of Finance, had his hands full, Washington quipped, "I wish he had his pockets full, too." As part of their elegant repast, Washington and his guests drank wine from some silver cups, which, though locally made, were somewhat deficient in their workmanship. Richard Peters, a delegate from Pennsylvania who sat nearby, informed Washington that the man who made the cups had since become a Quaker preacher. "I wish he had been a Quaker preacher before he had made the cups," Washington replied. "You think the penitence would have been good for the cups," La Luzerne added, catching General Washington's humorous spirit. Learning that Thomas Paine was currently living in nearby Bordentown, General Washington invited him to stay at Rocky Hill, hoping to get Congress to acknowledge Paine's importance to the American Revolution and reward him for his literary contributions during the war. In his letter of invitation, Washington told Paine, "Your presence may remind Congress of your past services to this country, and if it is in my power to impress them, command my best exertions with freedom, as they will be rendered cheerfully by one who entertains a lively sense of the importance of your works." Paine accepted Washington's invitation and soon came to visit. His reminiscences confirmed David Howell's portrayal of Washington at Rocky Hill. Payne similarly depicted him letting down his guard, indulging his sense of fun, and devoting his intellect to something beyond the battlefield. Considering what some local residents said about the Millstone River, both Washington and Payne gave their scientific curiosity free rein. The locals had told them that the river could actually be set on fire. So many people mentioned this New Jersey phlegathon that Washington decided to perform an experiment to test what they had told him. To make the experiment work, he and Payne learned they had to stir the mud on the river bottom and then hold a torch made from straw or paper slightly above the surface of the water. Once everything was ready, they chose Wednesday evening, November 5th, to attempt the experiment. They placed a scow on the river near the mill dam. General Benjamin Lincoln, David Cobb, and three or four soldiers joined Washington and Payne in the scow to help them perform the experiment. Washington armed the soldiers with poles to stir up the mud, and he and Payne, one at the bow, the other at the stern, each had a roll of cartridge paper, which they lit and held 2 or 3 inches above the surface of the water. The soldiers stirred, the gas bubble surfaced, and sure enough, the gas was ignited by the burning cartridge paper Washington held above the water. As darkness fell, flames covered the surface of the water, giving the Millstone River an eerie glow. Though verifying their hypothesis, neither Washington nor Payne knew exactly what they had discovered. Payne theorized that the gas caused yellow fever. Its usefulness would remain unknown for decades to come, but George Washington was experimenting with natural gas, which would eventually be a vital source of energy for the nation. George and Martha were unable to proceed directly from Princeton to Mount Vernon together as they had planned. He had to return to Newburgh to take care of some last-minute business. Before another month had passed, he was back on the road heading south again. On December 4th, Washington formally parted from his officers at France's Tavern in New York City. From there, he continued farther south, being touted and celebrated wherever he went. The Continental Congress had appointed December 11th as a day of Thanksgiving. By then, General Washington had reached Philadelphia, where he attended a service conducted by the Reverend Dr. John Rogers, who delivered a sermon lavishly praising him. Rogers had this Thanksgiving sermon printed as "The Divine Goodness Displayed in the American Revolution," and sent Washington a copy for his library at Mount Vernon. Washington lingered in Philadelphia a few more days, attending a magnificent dinner and a ball in his honor. Besides reacquainting himself with old friends, he took the opportunity to make some new ones. He was drawn to people who offered not flattery and accolades, but practical advice he could put to use. One new friend he made was Samuel Vaughan, an English merchant and Jamaica planter. Earlier that year, Vaughan and his family had left London to settle in Philadelphia. They were currently living with Richard Bache and his wife Sarah, the daughter of Vaughan's good friend Benjamin Franklin. In London, Vaughan had moved in the same circles as Franklin, befriending the city's leading scientists and foremost dissenting ministers. Like Franklin, Vaughan was attuned to the latest developments in science and technology. As Washington spoke with him about some new building projects he planned for Mount Vernon, their conversation turned to the topic of cement. Vaughan recommended a book on the subject by Brian Higgins, a British physician and scientist who had been part of his intellectual circle in London. Not only did Vaughan recommend experiments and observations made with the view of improving the art of composing and applying calcareous cements, he lent Washington his personal copy of the work. Washington's interaction with Vaughan provides a good example of how the book borrowing and lending process worked in early America. Their conversation about building projects encouraged Vaughan to mention Higgins's experiments. Vaughan's willingness to help Washington prompted him to loan the book. Accepting the gracious offer, Washington brought the volume with him to Mount Vernon. Reading Higgins's experiments, he took extensive notes from it, or, in his words, extracted such parts as I mean to carry into practice. Returning Higgins's experiments, Washington thanked Vaughan, but asked if he would clarify something about stucco. And now, my good sir, as I have touched upon the business of stuccoing, permit me to ask you if the rooms with which it is encrusted are painted, generally, or are they left of the natural color which is given by the cement made according to Mr. Higgins's mode of preparing it? Ultimately, the notes Washington took from Vaughan's copy of Higgins proved insufficient. He remembered many valuable ideas from the book that he had not written down and wanted a copy of his own. Washington soon added Higgins's experiments to his Mount Vernon library. His correspondence with Vaughan clarifies a bibliographical incongruity. Why did Washington take extensive notes from books he had in his library? In this instance, he made his notes before he acquired the book. Only after he realized that his notes were inadequate did he obtain a copy of the book for himself. Other books from which Washington took extensive notes may have a similar history. He borrowed friends' books and transcribed or summarized selected passages from them to obviate the need to acquire them himself. Only when he noticed his notes were inadequate, in other words, when he recognized discrepancies between the notes he took from a work and his memory of reading it, did he obtain a copy of the work for his personal library. Their book exchange solidified the friendship between Vaughan and Washington. The two would keep in contact with one another as time went on. When business brought Vaughan to London in the early 1790s, he used the opportunity to send Washington some of the latest British books and pamphlets. These works covered such topics as the French Revolution, the thought of Edmund Burke, Russian politics, the voyages of Prince Madoc, the legendary Welsh explorer who supposedly discovered America 3 centuries before Columbus, and the life and death of one of America's greatest British supporters, Richard Price. Leaving Philadelphia on his way home from the war, Washington continued to Annapolis, where the Confederation Congress had temporarily relocated. On December 23rd, he formally submitted the resignation of his military commission as Commander-in-Chief, announcing to Congress, "Having now finished the work assigned me, I retire from the great theater of action," and bidding an affectionate farewell to the august body under whose orders I have so long acted, I here offer my commission and take my leave of all the employments of public life. After his announcement, Washington got back on the road. A hard day's ride brought him to the Potomac. The ferries soon brought him to the other side of the river. Now, no more than a few miles separated him from his beloved home, which he had seen only once since the war began. The joy of coming home was tinged with melancholy. The family had changed considerably since he had left Mount Vernon at the start of the war. At that time, his stepson, Jack Custis, was entering his second year of marriage to Nellie Calvert. Jack had wanted to join the army, but his mother and stepfather opposed it. Jack and Nellie divided their time between Mount Airy and Mount Vernon. Nellie had since given birth to 5 children, 4 surviving beyond infancy. Nellie had been a positive influence on Jack, helping him achieve a seriousness and sense of purpose he had lacked before their marriage. As an adult, Jack assumed new responsibilities, being elected to the Virginia House of Burgesses in 1778. Still, he could not shake his desire to serve in the war and urged his stepfather to let him join the army. Returning to Virginia in 1781, Washington, with Martha's consent, finally relented, allowing her only son to join the campaign against the British in Virginia. Sadly, Jack contracted camp fever during the siege of Yorktown and died shortly after the British surrender. Nellie, in poor health since her second-to-last pregnancy, had sent her youngest daughter, Eleanor Park Custis, also nicknamed Nellie, to Mount Vernon to be nursed. Similarly, her last child and only son, George Washington Park Custis, or Wash, as he became known in the family, had also come to Mount Vernon to be nursed. Since she had recently remarried, her two youngest children remained at Mount Vernon to be raised by their grandmother and her famous husband. Saddened by Jack's death, George and Martha Washington found solace in the joy the two little children gave them. In the coming years, the halls of Mount Vernon would ring with the sounds of the two Custis children. The sight of Mount Vernon in the distance quickly dispelled whatever Washington was contemplating as he neared home. Having returned home earlier, Martha anxiously awaited her husband. In a matter of minutes, the two were reunited. It was Christmas Eve.